A Yellowstone County official describes a racist email he sent as, quote, the way Montanans talk. Good evening. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. And that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Missoula County hopes more people send in their ballots for Tuesday's city election. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a diabetes expert about how to manage the disease. Before we get to our top story, we have this breaking news. CBS News is reporting that the TSA officer shot and killed by a gunman at the Los Angeles airport today was a behavioral detection officer who had recently transferred there from Montana. That's according to the president of the American Federation of Government Employees, J. David Cox Sr. He is the first TSA officer killed in the line of duty. His identity has not yet been released.
Yellowstone County Treasurer and County Superintendent of Schools, Max Lennington, says his use of racist and anti-gay slurs in an email were a private message to his sister and reflected his anger that President Barack Obama was reelected. The Billings Gazette reports Yellowstone County Attorney Scott Twido is investigating whether there are grounds to recall the Lennington for comments made in an email sent from his work computer last year. News director Sally Mock spoke with Lennington this afternoon about the email, which he confirms he sent.
Yes, but it was a personal email to my sister. It wasn't a public email.
Do you stand by what you said in the email?
Well, absolutely. Well, you had to kind of know the prior story to figure it out. I was real disappointed when my candidate, Mitt Romney, wasn't elected. Now, my sister lives, they ranch in, up in central Montana, and shortly after the election, this would have been about a year ago, it was like the 12th of November 2012. Shortly after the election, she emailed me and said something like, why do you think we lost? And that's when I that was about the answer that I gave her.
If I can read that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it says, it, quote, it must mean there are more lesbians, queers, Indians, Mexicans, and then you use the N-word than the rest of us.
Keep in mind, this was a personal email of mine to my sister.
Do you feel like those terms are something that might offend people?
It possibly, but I wouldn't say it in public. It wasn't meant to be. It wasn't meant to go public. It was strictly a comment to my sweet sister.
But those are terms you would use in private.
Well, I've never used them before. Again, but I can say this was a private email conversation with my sister.
You can see why people might be offended by those terms.
Absolutely, absolutely. If I'd have known that it was going to end up on the front page of everything, I wouldn't have done it. Obviously, I was real disappointed that Mitt Romney didn't win, and so was she. And I just a little bit teed off at the whole thing, and that's why I kind of blew my cork there, I guess.
It sounds like you do regret saying it now.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I have, like I told the Gazette, I haven't said that to anybody ever, anybody other than his family member.
You did also. The paper says that you did say that if, quote, people got out with the real people, you'll see that people still use that word periodically.
Well, the point I'm trying to make there is this is Montana, and we're just a little bit more open and probably not quite as politically correct as we would be if we were in the Beltway or someplace. That was the point I was trying to make. I'm a Montana born and bred, so I'm fairly open with in my speech. And you know, I may say some things periodically that other people might not appreciate, but that's kind of the way we do it. From where I came from, I'm 70 years old, so I was born and raised at Central Montana, and that's kind of the way we talked. And again, I'm sorry, but that's what I meant by being real.
Do you think not using those terms is being politically correct?
By not saying those terms? Oh, yeah, sure. It would be more politically correct, I guess. And if I had been in a political setting, I probably wouldn't have used those terms.
Are you racist, Mr. Lennington?
Absolutely not. I've got a granddaughter that's partly Negroid. No, I'm not a racist at all.
You're also a superintendent of schools for Yellowstone County, correct?
In name only. So, a lot of people don't understand what that is. The county superintendents are more financial than anything, and we fund school districts, rural schools. And since I'm the county treasurer, all the information that the school districts require comes from the county treasurer's office, so it's a logical place to put the county superintendents.
You have no intention of resigning over this?
Well, not right away. I wanted to visit with my county attorney a little bit.
It sounds like you're considering that, though.
Well, my term is up next year, so I don't know. We're still kind of in that realm. We just haven't talked about it enough yet.
You're getting a lot of support?
I have 7 or 8 people support this. In fact, I've had no non-supporters this morning. I'm sure there'll be a flurry of letters to the editor, but I've had 7 personal either visits or calls this morning, and they were all positive.
That was Yellowstone County Treasurer Max Lennington. Lennington has worked for Yellowstone County government for more than 40 years. His term ends on December 31st, 2014.
And in other news from around the state, attorneys for a Colorado man charged with killing an Eastern Montana teacher say his mental disabilities make him unfit to stand trial. The attorneys asked a state judge today to commit 24-year-old Michael Keith Spell to a state facility for up to 60 days to undergo a mental examination. The Parachute, Colorado man faces a felony murder charge in the death of Sherry Arnold, a Sydney High School teacher killed in January 2012 while on her morning run. A co-defendant pleaded guilty under a deal with prosecutors. Spell could face the death penalty if convicted. Court records in Colorado show Spell was declared incompetent by a judge in 2010 in a Garfield County drug case. His defense attorneys say he also has a prior diagnosis of mental disability.
A Montana state prison inmate convicted of killing another inmate in an argument over stolen headphones has been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. District Judge Brad Newman sentenced 32-year-old Sean Duncan Morrison on Thursday in Deer Lodge. Morrison was convicted in November 2012 of deliberate homicide for killing 53-year-old Julio Santiago Jr. in September 2011. Court records say Santiago was punched, choked, and his face and neck were cut. Newman sentenced Morrison to a consecutive 10 years for the use of a weapon, followed by 15 years for possession of a weapon by an inmate. Defense attorney Tom Bartleson sought the possibility of parole, saying his client suffered from mental illness. State officials countered Morrison has personality disorders that do not meet the law's definition of mental illness.
Far less than half the mail-in ballots for next Tuesday's city election in Missoula have been turned into the election office. Election supervisor Vicki Zier says about 12,000 filled-out ballots have been returned, but over 29,000 are still out and 7,000 came back as undeliverable.
It's about the same as what was in 2009, and you usually see an increase in number of undeliverables after a high-profile presidential election, just because you have such a high number of people who register to vote, and then they move, or so once you move, a lot of people believe that their address, that we get the address update from the post office, which we do not. You do have to complete a voter registration card. So if you've moved, your ballot isn't forwarded and it comes back to us.
Zier says the election office does send out a notice that the ballot was undeliverable, and that notice is forwardable to the new address.
The governing body has the choice of sending ballots out anywhere from 15 to 25 days. And this election, we sent ballots out 15 days before the election. That gets it a little tight. I would say for undeliverables, especially following a presidential, we might need a little more time just so people can come in and retrieve their undeliverables. But we still have plenty of time. People can go to the fairgrounds and pick them up.
Even with less than half the mailed-out ballots returned so far, Zier says that's still a much better response in a local election than previous turnouts at the polls.
Poll elections, we probably would have been around 10 or 12%. This is still, we're at 25% as of this morning when I looked at the report. I believe before we're done, we'll be somewhere between 35 and 40% turnout. Do I think that's great? Absolutely not, because I always think we should have real high numbers. But that is still really high for a city election. Unfortunately, the elections that we have the highest voter turnout is the presidential election, and most local elections do not have that kind of turnout.
Mailed-in ballots should be sent as soon as possible. The ballots have to be in the election office by 8 p.m. Tuesday. Ballots can also be dropped off at 8 locations throughout the city. Those sites are listed in your ballot instructions. You can also go to the website MissoulaVotes.com to check the status of your ballot and get more information.
Governor Steve Bullock says he doesn't plan any immediate changes to the state's pension overhaul if pending lawsuits result in a portion of it being thrown out. Bullock said Friday he thinks the legislature's overhaul plan he signed this year can be successful even if courts strike planned cuts for retirees. A day earlier, retired public employees challenged the plan's cut to their annual 3% inflationary increases. Retired teachers had previously filed a lawsuit challenging the changes affecting them. They argued it was an unconstitutional change in contract. Projections show it would take much longer to balance the systems if the retirees win the challenges. But Bullock says he would want to see the effect of the pension fix for a couple of years before making any other changes.
The Jazz Montana Festival, being held today and tomorrow in Bozeman, is celebrating women in jazz. Tonight's performance features woodwind master and alto saxophonist Madeline Mad Duran of San Francisco. Duran started playing sax when she was 12 and was first trained as a classical musician, though she fell in love with jazz at a young age. At the time, and still today, women jazz instrumentalists were rare, but Duran says that's changing.
Now, there's some awfully talented young female jazz musicians. When I was growing up, yeah, I was one of the only ones. I was kind of an oddity, but I just kept doing it because it just felt so good.
Duran will perform with local jazz musicians tonight at 8 o'clock at the Ellen Theater in Bozeman. Another sax player, Chelsea Baratz, will perform tomorrow night with the MSU Concert Jazz Ensemble, beginning at 7:30 at the MSU School of Music's Reynolds Recital Hall. For more information about the festival, go to the website jazzmt.org. We will have a feature interview with Madeline Duran next week during Montana Evening Edition.
A free diabetes awareness program is being held tomorrow at Missoula's Providence St. Patrick Hospital. Diabetes is a serious and growing problem across the country. The coordinator of Providence St. Patrick's Diabetes Care and Prevention Center, Jennifer Troop, says managing the symptoms of diabetes can seem like a daunting task for those uninitiated. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Troop says taking control of the disease is not only possible but can change the course of a life for the better. There are basically two kinds of diabetes, type 2 and type 1.
Type 1, only about 5% to 7% of the population has. It is growing. That's due to an autoimmune disorder. They're not really sure what causes it. There is a genetic link with it, but basically that there's the beta cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. And some suggestion has been like early exposure to cow's milk, stress, an environmental toxin they're not sure of. Basically causes the body to destroy those cells that produce insulin, and there's an absence of insulin production, and so, of course, you know, blood sugars will go up, and some, and typically they're hospitalized in diabetic ketoacidosis, and they have to go on external insulin injections to live. If they don't, they die. It's that simple, and it's a very usually sudden, boom, I'm sick. Now, about 90% of the people with diabetes have type 2. There is actually a very strong genetic link with type 2. If anyone out there, you know, has type 2, a parent with type 2, a brother or sister, they're at risk. There's a high, high genetic risk, but also our lifestyle. You know, I've read research that said about 80% of type 2 diabetes could be prevented with a healthier lifestyle. And so that's if someone gains their weight in their abdomen, if they're inactive, if they, you know, have gained, put on 20, 30 pounds, they're overweight or obese, all those are high risks for type 2 diabetes. So those beta cells in the pancreas that we talked about with type 1, well, those are definitely a part here. They are the insulin-producing cells. And over time, when someone is really overweight, eating a lot of high-fat, high-carb foods, that puts a strain on that pancreas, and it will overproduce insulin for a while to compensate and try and keep those blood sugars down. And insulin takes, like, the food you eat and kind of helps it get into the cells and keeps blood sugars at a normal range and keeps the cells full of energy and everybody feels good. Well, eventually, there's this insulin resistance happens, and the cells no longer recognize the insulin, basically. It can't get in and do its job. So you see there's more and more insulin being produced to try and force that glucose in and have it do its job. Well, eventually, the pancreas just gets tired out. Blood sugars rise to a point of being diagnosed with diabetes. Once someone has type 2, they may first start with an oral medication, diet, exercise, prescription. But over time, and the estimate is at least about 10 years after diagnosis, they will have to go on insulin.
So, Ms. Troop, from a national perspective, again, how many of us have diabetes?
About 8.6%. That was based on 2011 data from the Centers for Disease Control. That's their estimate, but again, the estimate for 2050 is the one I always throw out there, which is 1 in 3 will have diabetes by 2050. We know about 79 million Americans have prediabetes, and that's about 30% of the population are at risk. It will overtake our nation as the number one health problem.
Here in Montana, it's a little less.
It's a little less. More in the, I think, 6.5% range. That doesn't include Indian country. In Indian country, you know, again, they're about 2.3 times more likely to have diabetes on the reservations. So in general, it's about 6.5%. But again, prediabetes is high, about 30%. And again, in Montana, and it is growing. 20 years ago, you didn't see all the food places, right? All the chains that have come in. We were more active, right? A lot of our farming, logging, those types of jobs that were really active have gone away. So now we have more desk jobs. Our state's getting heavier. We used to be, you know, like one of the leanest states in the nation. We still are lower than the southern states, which we call the diabetes belt down there in the south, where Georgia is, Alabama, and Mississippi, but we are rising.
You've mentioned weight a lot. I'm a tall, skinny guy. I'm embarrassed about my diet. It is awful, but I am actually fairly active. Is my lean build, my skinny build, does that work in my favor?
You know, that does work in your favor. Now, do you have anybody in your family that has diabetes?
No.
Okay. So that also, that's probably even more powerful. Mm. The fact that you don't have anybody, you know, a genetic risk in your family. The fact that, yeah, that you are, you know, at a healthy weight. If you did gain weight, where would you gain it?
In my gut.
Yeah. And so that's a risk. If your blood pressure starts to go up, if your cholesterol levels start to go up, those are all risks. And then inactivity, and you mentioned you're inactive.
No, very active.
You're actually very active. That's probably your number one thing in your favor.
Yeah, but I eat cheese active and starches and just garbage. I do.
Well, and exercise can't make up for a poor diet. I mean, if I can tell you, if you didn't exercise, you know, you'd probably be in a different situation. You'd probably at least be 10 to 20 pounds heavier and those types of things. Diet and exercise are 50-50 really in this game. So half of it is exercise. Half of it is looking at what you eat. So, you know, some basic advice we give folks is, again, you know, eat at least three times a day. Track what you eat. You know, write it down. Come see us. Meet with us. We'll look at that with you, because if you eat a lot of high sugary, low fiber foods, again, that's going to put that weight on that pancreas of shooting up, give me some more insulin, and then, the highs and lows kind of thing that can happen. So we always recommend whole grains, you know, watching the fat. High fat diets, that contributes to insulin resistance. If I eat a lot of fat, my insulin is not going to work as well for me. A basic guideline I give all my patients is try and have half your plate come from non-starchy fruits and vegetables, such as broccoli, carrots, tomatoes, cucumbers, lettuce, cauliflower. So that'd be my first advice for you. Look at those vegetables. Try and have more of your plate come from vegetables, and then look and fit in a few whole grains in there. Do you like whole wheat bread?
Yep. Salads, whole wheat bread, that sort of stuff. I love
good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, it's a step at a time, too. You know, we can't do an overhaul overnight, but little changes add up to a big benefit.
It's self-discipline, and I've lost that for some reason.
Oh, you better come in and see us then.
And we'll talk about that in just a second. What are some of the warning signs, Ms. Troop? You're walking around. You have no idea that you may have diabetes. What are some telltale signs that something may be wrong?
Well, I think one of the things to know is sometimes you don't know, but your blood sugars are very, very high. So one thing, just like how blood pressure is a silent killer, diabetes can be that way as well. However, most folks, the common signs they have would be, like, if they find them, they have an unquenchable thirst. I hear that a lot from my patients. I just drink and drink and drink, but I never quench my thirst. Okay? That's a sign. If you're going to the bathroom, urinating frequently, like every few hours, you just always have to go to the restroom, then that's a sign that you might have diabetes. Also, blurred vision. We see folks will come in, they go and get the new glasses because they're having a hard time seeing. And guess what happens? When their blood sugars improve, those glasses don't work anymore because the blurred vision has gone away and they actually have gotten their vision back where it was before. So those are three, I would say, the three most common things that we see. Also, some folks, if they have type 1, tip more, like if they have unexplained weight loss. You know, they're just so hungry and they just keep losing weight. That's another big sign, too. Type 2, a lot of times we won't see. If anything, they might have a weight gain because that insulin, they're getting that, they have that extra insulin being produced in their body. And insulin's a fat-storing hormone. So you typically are going to gain if you have more of that and you're eating more.
The theme of tomorrow's conference in Missoula is control is the goal, and we were just talking a little bit about that. What is this control? What are you talking about?
Yeah, right. What is that? So control is talking about blood sugar control. Okay, so there are numbers out there from the American Diabetes Association, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, from studies that show that certain numbers will help prevent the complications of diabetes, and those are things like eye disease, nerve disease, kidney disease, heart disease, to name a few of them. So basically, if your blood sugar, when you wake up in the morning, so we call that a fasting blood sugar, right? So you've been like on 8 hours without eating. If you're at 90 to 130 when you wake up, that's a good number. And then 2 hours after you eat is another key time to test your blood sugar. If you're less than 140 to 80, depending on the person, so less than 140 sometimes for folks is where we want them, at least less than 180, you know, never higher than that. those are two key numbers we look at when someone's testing their blood sugars daily with a glucose meter. We also look at a hemoglobin A1C, which we are offering those at the conference at no charge, 3 months. That's a three-month average of someone's blood sugars. You want that less than 7% in most people. So those are kind of those numbers that we look at of control. We also look at blood pressure control. We want that less than 140 over 80 in someone with diabetes. And we want their cholesterol, you know, in a good range, less than 200 for total. We want their HDL, the good stuff, over, you know, 40 or 50, and we want their LDL, the bad stuff, under 100, triglycerides under 150. So it's kind of all those numbers. You got the heart with the blood pressure and cholesterol. You got the blood sugar numbers. That all of that, we want to get that under control. And that's how these folks with diabetes live long, healthy lives, absent of complications.
So that is possible.
It is very possible.
And control also in terms of self-control, your diet?
Diet and exercise, that lifestyle piece, taking the right medications at the right time when you need them, getting you on the right medication, and then looking at how much carbohydrate am I having at each meal? What type of carbohydrates am I choosing? What type of fats am I choosing? Am I getting my fiber in? I mean, those are all things we help folks with. Am I exercising? Am I getting at least 150 minutes a week of walking in? It doesn't have to be running marathons. You might, you know, be a marathon runner, but it doesn't have to be this intense, overwhelming task. It's just moving more, period. It helps keep our blood sugars under control.
Tell us about tomorrow's event.
Well, we have an exciting day planned with just a host of different speakers. I'm really excited about our panel we're having. We're going to look at healthcare reform, what's going on right now for the person with diabetes. We're having people from industry come and talk about what they see happening. We're going to have, you know, topics on exercise from a physical therapist. A dietitian is going to speak on nutrition. And we have Dr. Shannon, who's an endocrinologist from Olympia, Washington, who's our guest kind of keynote speaker, giving us an update on diabetes. Also, we have mental health, behavioral health type of, I think one of the biggest things I see folks say, right, they know what they need to do, but they're not doing it. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about that. How do you break those behaviors and do what you need to do? Doors open at 7. We have exhibitors. We have about 20 exhibitors that will be there, from pharmaceutical companies to local companies to departments at St. Patrick Hospital. There's no registration. Doors open at 7. The lectures start at 8. We will have free hemoglobin A1Cs as long as we have the supplies for them, and it should be about 150 to 200. And then we have blood pressure checks, and we're serving breakfast and lunch. So we're just hoping to get a lot of folks out to really learn and empower themselves to take care of this disease, or if they are at risk, they can learn more about it, or if they have a family member that they're living with that they want to learn more to help them, you know, that this meets all of those needs.
Jennifer True, Program Coordinator for Providence Medical Group Diabetes Care and Prevention Center. Boy, informative stuff. Thanks a lot for your time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Now for this weekend's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with some patchy fog and lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, rain showers are likely with highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Sunday, there's a chance of snow and rain showers are likely in the valleys. Expect highs in the 30s to lower 40s. Central Montana tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with highs 45 to 55 degrees. And on Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow showers. Highs should be in the 30s. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. In southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with lows 20 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs 45 to 55 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 35 miles per hour tomorrow afternoon. Sunday should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 25 to 35 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Marika Wells.
I'm Marika Wells, Administrator for Hospice of Missoula. This is my 5 minutes, and I'm going to title it, Death. Talk about it. Picture a black billboard, and in big, white, bold letters, Death, period. Talk about it. Last week, I watched a fantastic TED Talk titled, Let's Talk About Dying, by Peter Saul. I highly recommend this talk. And in it, he says, how we die lives on in the minds of everybody who survives us. Think about that. How we die lives on in the minds of everyone who survives us. This makes me want to die well, to die beautifully, with grace and with strength. I want my children, my friends, and my family to be aware of my wishes, to understand, even though it will hurt, that I'm dying. I don't want people to be in much pain. I don't want to be in much pain, although I could tolerate some. I want to be at home with the people I love around me. I want to know that I won't be alone. I want to know that someone will be there to help me and to help my family to understand, to reassure us that this strange and difficult thing happening to my body is normal. I want to be in control. But enough about me. What do you want? Consider it. We didn't wait until we were 9 months pregnant to learn about the birthing process. I mean, can you imagine? Showing up in labor, about to give birth, without any care or education, screaming, "Help! Somebody! Walk me through this having a baby thing here!" What a miserable experience that would be, trying to make any thoughtful choices about this process when you are in pain, terrified, possibly alone, and your body is trying to push a human out. No, even with expert care and education, giving birth is a tremendous and beautiful process. So is dying. I'm not the first person to compare giving birth and dying. They are both transitions. Both are natural, spiritual even. Both have medical implications. Both can encompass some suffering. One staggering difference, however, is that dying is not optional. Another difference is we rarely talk about or witness how someone dies. Here are some facts to think about. Roughly 80% of us want to die at home, and only 20% do. Only 1 out of 10 people over 80 will die of cancer. Due to incredible medical advances, most of us will die of multiple organ failure, which will likely land us in a hospital ICU. We will experience 7 times more stress when dying in a hospital ICU than anywhere else. Still, about 1 in 5 of us will die there. Sudden death has become very rare, only 6% of us. That means being hit by a car, having a heart attack while sleeping, and etc. A meager 10% of us will survive CPR if our heart has stopped. And if you are over 85, that drops significantly to 3%. 80% of Medicare dollars are spent in the last 6 months of life. That's a lot of bad news. Good news? Well, not everyone will think this is good news, but again, dying is natural. It's normal, and it is a healthy thing, and you have choices. There is help. There are experts even who can provide care and education to you so you can avoid a scenario like the 9-month pregnant woman we talked about earlier. Hospice is not a scary word. It's a gift. Hospice can make dying a lot less frightening by shedding light on the process and providing support and comfort to you. These facts may be some good news that you're looking for. Hospice provides end-of-life care and education to you in your home. Your home can be an assisted living, independent living, skilled nursing facility, a residential home, an apartment, a bus, a tent, even the hospital will come to you. End-of-life care is a benefit of Medicare, so if you receive Medicare, there is no additional cost to you to receive hospice. You have earned this benefit. Private insurance, Medicaid, and veterans benefits also cover hospice at 100%. You can live for months, even years, while receiving hospice care. Once, however, you receive hospice care and say you change your mind and seek a cure, then when you are ready, you can change your mind and not receive that benefit. And again, you can choose hospice when you're ready. Hospices provide emotional support to families for 13 months after their loved one has passed. There is free education about hospice, and they will come to you. Just call. You don't have to be alone. You don't have to be in pain. You can be in control. Use your voice, ask for what you want, and celebrate the choices you have. And that's death. Talk about it.
Marika Wells is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. And don't forget to turn back your clocks an hour before you go to bed Saturday night.